I get to talking and I lose track of time. So I hear lots of folks enjoying being together this morning. That's wonderful. We're going to wrap up our study of Genesis just short of Joseph. We're not going to look at Joseph right now. But we're going to be looking at Judah. We're going to focus on him this morning. He is called the lion's whelp in Genesis 49. Do you remember who is the most important descendant of Judah? Who is that? David, but second, not second to David. Who is the ultimate descendant? Jesus our Lord. Hebrews 7:14. He is descended from Judah. Do you remember in the book of Revelation, Revelation 4, I guess it's Revelation 5, when John is told to look at the Lion of Judah, and he turns, and what does he see? He sees a lamb as if slain. So Jesus is of the tribe of Judah. He is compared to a lion. That is a messianic symbol referring to Jesus. And it is first used in Genesis 49. But shouldn't have the firstborn been the recipient of the Abrahamic blessing, pass on the inheritance from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob? Who was Jacob's firstborn? It wasn't Judah. Reuben. So we're going to start with Reuben as we quickly work our way toward Jacob. This is tying up some loose ends. I know we haven't had a detailed study of Genesis, but I want to point a couple of things out to you. In Genesis 29, we have the birth of Reuben, and this is what Leah, his mother, said when he was born. She said, hopefully now my husband will love me, because I've given him a son, his firstborn. And you see the first part of verse 31, it says, the Lord saw that Leah was unloved. Well, Leah wants more than anything for her husband to love her. Why didn't Jacob love her? All right, she wasn't pretty. And she wasn't whom? Rachel. You remember the story. We're not going to rehash it because we've already looked at it in the course of our study. But first time he saw Rachel, love at first sight, wanted to marry her. He was deceived and had to marry Leah first. So he ended up with two wives. Two wives. What a crazy situation, home life that was. Very dysfunctional. So Reuben is called the lion's whelp in Genesis 49. And what's going on there in that closing chapter of Genesis? There are 50 chapters in Genesis. And Jacob is giving his farewell address, as it were, to his children and giving them blessings and commentary on their lives and their futures. And when he says these good, sweet words about Reuben, he says, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, but uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. We don't talk about this very much because it is rather sordid. And we're going to be looking at a lot of sordid stuff today. But in Genesis 35, verse 22, we are told that Israel, and that's referring to Jacob, remember Jacob's name had been changed to Israel. Now Israel lived in that land. Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. What was Reuben trying to do by sleeping with his father's concubine in this very patriarchal system that they lived in? He was trying to usurp himself. He was, usurp his father, assert himself as the future leader. That's what they did. Absalom when he was usurping the throne, asserted himself by sleeping with David's concubines. That's just part of that nasty culture. I'm the new leader. How did Jacob respond to that? Was he proud of his son, saying, "You're being so assertive"? Now, he didn't like it at all, and he rejected him as his heir. So that was a great sin, and what we see is it's also a great loss. If you want to turn over to 1 Chronicles 5, read a couple of verses, but I have them on the screen, so we can read it together. 1 Chronicles 5 gives us divine commentary on Reuben's legacy. Now, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, and then we've got this parenthetical. For he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph. And then it continues, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. Isn't that something? Because he tried to prevail. You see that there? Though Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came the leader, Reuben was rejected. Reuben was rejected as the firstborn because of his sin with Bilhah, trying to assert himself. Now, does Reuben just say, "Oh, well, I know Dad's upset with me, and there's nothing I can do about it"? Well, we're not going to look at the Joseph story right now, but when you get into it later, I want to mention a couple of passages. The Joseph narrative begins in chapter 37, and this is what you see after Joseph is thrown into the pit. I know we know the story very, very well. Genesis 37, verse 22. So Joseph's in the pit. What did the brothers want to do to Joseph? Their own flesh and blood, their brother. They wanted to kill him. Who was the one who said, no, let's not kill him? Who was it? Reuben. Why? Because Reuben was the oldest, and he was the most mature, and he was so concerned about Joseph, his younger half-brother. Exactly. He wanted to get back in the good graces of his father. If he was able to save Jacob's favorite son, see how dysfunctional this family is, shed no blood, throw him into this pit, and he ended up saving Joseph's life, that he might rescue him from their hands to restore him to his father. It was not because he was so selfless. He was motivated by selfishness. All right, much later in the Joseph narrative, when the brothers have already gone to Egypt, gotten the grain, and then they come back to Canaan in the time of famine, they eat all that grain, and they have to go back. But they can't go back. Why? They had to take Benjamin with them, and who was insisting, "I'm not taking my youngest son. I'm not letting you take my youngest son." That was Jacob. And this is what Reuben said in response. He's still trying to get back in his dad's good graces. Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "You may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you." So what if Cody, who's off vacationing today, what if Cody said, "Mom and Dad, if I don't do what it is or get whatever it is you want, I you can kill Kaylee." How would you respond to that? Yeah, I'd rather have her than you, buddy. This is nuts. Is this selflessness on Reuben's part? You can kill my two sons, your grandsons. Now, this is in sharp contrast to Judah, who had his own problems, and we're going to look at that for the remainder of our class this morning in just a moment. Judah is the one who does rise up and say, no, I will be surety for Benjamin. If he doesn't come back, you can kill me. Big difference. Judah had grown up. He had matured, and he was no longer as selfish as he had been in his previous life. So here's the family tree. Leah and Rachel are his two wives. We've already talked about this, and you know why there were children by Leah's handmaid, Zilpah, and Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah, the woman that Reuben had defiled. So who should have received the birthright? Reuben should have, but he is rejected. Who's next in line? Simeon. You remember Leah had these kids, these first four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, one after the other. Then Rachel said, I can't have kids, so I'll have Bilhah have some kids. It was a huge mess. But Reuben is the one who was rejected. Then what happens? Well, you've got the events of chapter 34. Genesis 34, which we have skipped over up to this point. And we're not going to look at it a whole lot, but I'll start reading here in verse 1. It says, now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. His soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this girl for my wife. Sometimes this is referred to as the rape of Dinah, or the defilement of Dinah. But he has really hurt this young lady, Dinah. And that's all we know about her. Now, does this mean, because the only daughter of Jacob we ever talk about is Dinah, does that mean there were no other daughters? There were other daughters. When Jacob is told that his son has been killed and taken, it says that, this is Genesis 37, verse 35, all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. So the only one that's ever named is Dinah. There were others. But Leah, look at this. She had at least seven children for Jacob. And did Jacob ever love his wife? Ever love Leah? No, he never did. At least we're not told that he had a change of heart. So Simeon and Levi want to avenge their sister. Do you think Dan and Naphtali or Gad and Asher were overly worried about it? They're not full brothers. They're half-brothers to her. Simeon and Levi, they have the same mother, they have the same father. They want to protect her. And what do? I don't want to read the story, I just want somebody to summarize it for us, because it's terrible. Simeon and Levi go to the folks at Shechem and say, hey, we're so glad you want to be part of our family, we're going to join our families together. What would that do to the Abrahamic promise, by the way? That'd mess it up, wouldn't it? But Jacob was willing to go along with it. Isn't that crazy? But Simeon and Levi, they say, hey, that's great. We're going to become family. But if you want to be one of us, you have to be circumcised. Were they being sincere? No. Not at all. What did they want to do? By having all the men of Shechem circumcised, that would... What was the word you used? Okay, they would not be fit for. They would be incapacitated. And so these men are recovering from their surgery. And what does Simeon and Levi do? Kill them. And I'm sure they had help. But they're the leaders. How did Jacob respond to this? You know, we've been talking about how Jacob was a scoundrel and that he changed over time. You be the judge here. Yes, sir.
He was afraid that it would cause the rest of the family to rise up against him.
Oh, okay. So that would have been a serious issue as well. I'm going to drop down to the end of Genesis 34. You notice we're skipping over the details. Verse 30. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me. by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." I kind of emphasized a pronoun there, didn't I? What's Jacob worried about? What Doc said. He's worried they're going to slaughter them. But who is Jacob most worried about, do you think? Yeah, me, myself, and I. Jacob's grown in his faith, that is true, but he's still very selfish, self-centered, I would contend. So what about Simeon and Levi? Do either of them receive the Abrahamic promise? No, they do not. So I'm going to remove their names as well. And I'll remind you of something. The sons of Jacob, they become the tribes and inherit land. So Reuben received land. Simeon received land, didn't he? But it was in the middle of Judah's land. So Judah gets a lot. He gets a big section of the southern part of Canaan. And inside of it is the tribe of Simeon. You look at your map in the back of your Bible, maybe. Over time, what happens to the tribe of Simeon being in the middle of Judah? It shrinks, and it kind of gets smothered. They lose that land. And you remember when the kingdom split under Solomon, what tribe stayed with him? The royal tribe of Benjamin stayed with Judah, because Solomon was of the tribe of Judah. They're in the south. What about poor Simeon? they're still located in the south, but they were part of that rebellion that split. So Simeon didn't really have much of a chance of a long, prosperous existence. Those are my thoughts on the poor fella. What about Levi? How much land did he inherit? None. He became the priestly tribe. Now, that's not to say that the priesthood was a punishment. This was a tremendous honor for the tribe of Levi, quite frankly. They had the high priesthood. Moses and Aaron were Levites. Aaron was the first high priest. That's extremely important. But did Jesus descend from the tribe of Levi? No, he did not. Who is the one who received the Abrahamic promise, this land, nation, and seed promise? Judah. Now, by the way, who received the land inheritance, you might say, the double portion? Joseph. So Jacob had gotten both the birthright and that land, but it is interesting that Joseph is the one who does receive a special blessing in that his two sons, what were their names? Ephraim and Manasseh. They have tried. So what is the tribe of Joseph? You have the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Simeon, the tribe of Levi. No, they didn't inherit any land. The tribe of Judah. Where is the tribe of Joseph? There is no tribe of Joseph. But there is a tribe of Reuben. I'm sorry, of Ephraim and Manasseh. By the way, you remember how you saw with Jacob and Esau how Jacob received the inheritance, but was he the firstborn? He was not. He was younger. He came out 3 seconds later, or I don't know how long it was, but he came out of the womb and was the second born, but he had the preeminence nonetheless. That becomes a theme. What about... I'm losing my train of thought here all of a sudden. Ephraim Manasseh. Who was the older and who was the younger? Manasseh was the older. Ephraim got... Eventually, the northern kingdom of Israel is referred to as Ephraim. You see that in the prophets a lot. That's kind of interesting. When Jacob was blessing, he put his hands on the heads of Ephraim and Manasseh, and he had his right hand on Ephraim. And that upset Joseph. Why? He said, "Yeah, you're supposed to, Dad, you got it wrong here." He says, "No, I don't. I got it exactly where it's supposed to be. That's something else to think about as you read the story. Any thoughts you have on Reuben, Simeon, and Levi? Because we're about to start talking about Judah. Yes, sir.
Why is it called an out tribe of Manasseh?
Okay. The reason why is because originally what they were supposed to do was go into Canaan and conquer that land. But because they had such success on the east side of the Jordan as they were coming up toward Canaan, they were going to come from the east, they conquered land there, and they went ahead and inhabited it as well. So you have the half-tribe of Manasseh. I'm going to have to look at a map and remind myself of the other half-tribes. And you can read about that in Joshua. That's what they ended up doing, dividing the land up. So the 12 tribes, you've got the east tribe of Manasseh, and they also had land on the other side of the Jordan. Then also on that side is Gad and Reuben, but they didn't have any other land. So when you look at your map, you'll see east Manasseh and west Manasseh. So Manasseh had quite a bit of land, a lot of land, but Ephraim is the one who takes the preeminence over, over his brother Manasseh. Interesting. Any other questions or comments you'd like to make on Reuben, Simeon, and Levi? Good. We can go on. Somebody else? Okay. All right. We're going to talk about Judah. And we're going to look at some of the more sordid details in the Bible class, because I'm also going to talk about Judah in the sermon this morning. So just pretend you don't remember anything. Now we're going to look at it a little bit here. Judah is the one through whom the Abrahamic promise is going to come. Judah is going to have a child that will become the progenitor of Jesus. Why don't we look at that for a moment? Let's go over to Matthew chapter 1. We'll review that in a second here. Matthew chapter 1. Let me go ahead and advance to that. Matthew 1 records the genealogy of Jesus through Joseph, the adoptive father of Jesus. And notice what it says. This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And these names should sound very familiar to us. Verse 2, Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Reuben and his brothers. Is that what it says? Nope, Reuben is not the recipient of the Abrahamic promise. Judah and his brothers. Verse 3, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And Zerah's not the one that continues the line, it's Perez. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram, and so on and so forth until you get to David. Then from David until you get to Jesus. Judah became the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Now, up to this point, how many women have been mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus? Up to this point, none. This is an official genealogy. Male-dominant society. How often do they mention women, typically, in genealogies? Especially of kingly genealogies. They don't. How many women are mentioned in Jesus' genealogy? Several. I think it's five. Five women. You got Mary, of course, who's mentioned. And that's at the end. Verse 16, Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. And that's clearly identifying Mary as the birth mother, not Joseph as the birth father. Mary, of whom is referring to Mary. You got Tamar. There are several other women mentioned. Look at verse 5. Rahab. What do we know about Rahab? She helped the spies. What was her occupation? Prostitute. Was she a Jew? No, she had to become a proselyte. We're never told specifically about Tamar, but it seems that she was not a Jew either. That she was a Gentile. Don't know that. I can't be definitive on that. And I used to say, I assumed that she was a Jew, but I don't think that she was. Verse 6, David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. We're going to talk about David this morning as well. Who is that referring to? Never names her, but the wife of Uriah was Bathsheba. And that just reminds us of the sordid story in 2 Samuel 11. And Ruth. Where's Ruth? 5. Oh, I skipped over poor little Ruth. So, is this unusual, having all these women mentioned? Not only are they women, some of them are Gentiles, and some of them, their stories aren't very pretty, including Tamar. Let's talk about Tamar. Genesis 38. How many children does Judah have at the beginning of Genesis 38? How many sons does he have? 3. And the oldest is married to Tamar. We don't talk about this story very much. It's just kind of ugly. It's really ugly. And it says that Judah took a Canaanite as his wife. Wait a minute. I mean, what about the Abrahamic promise? Shouldn't he have married somebody who wasn't a Canaanite? What does that tell you about Judah's attitude? About his mindset? He's not really all that concerned. He's not giving great allegiance to God. We're not told much about that. Well, we're told in verse 7 that Judah's firstborn, who's married to Tamar, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. That's all we know. Maybe God just didn't like the fact that he had a name like I don't know. I don't know what happened. So, Judah says to his secondborn, Onan, this is what you need to do. You need to raise up seed. This is a practice in that day and time, the Levirate exception, I guess. And what that will do is allow Tamar to have an inheritance. I mean, women in this male dominant society, do they have any rights if they weren't connected with their husband? I mean, no land, no inheritance. She has no children. So she would have wealth through her husband, and if not through her husband, then through her children. Tamar has neither a husband, and she never had any children. So Judah says, all right, we need to help Tamar out here. And Onan refuses. Why? Because he's selfish. He knows, verse 9 says, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So he refused to impregnate Tamar. How did God respond to that? Killed him. So if you're Judah, and you have 3 sons, 2 of them die, who are you blaming? Your sons for being evil? Who does he blame? He blames Tamar. Maybe he blames God too, I don't know. But he blames Tamar, of course. And so, what does he say to Tamar? I've got a 3rd son here, and he's young, so this is what you need to do. Wait. Verse 11, Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, his 3rd son. For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. And she waits, and she waits. Shelah grows up, and is she ever allowed to have children through Shelah? So this isn't good for Tamar. She has nothing. She's just dependent on her own father. What does she decide to do? Take matters into her own hands. Judah, his Canaanite wife, Judah's wife dies. And she takes advantage of that, that emptiness in his life. And what does she do? Yes, sir. She sure does. And Judah comes wandering by. He sees this prostitute. And he says, no, I can't give in to that sexual temptation. I can't do it. No, he gives in. Does this situation remind you of anyone else? You have someone who is making it very easy for you to have an improper sexual relationship, and they don't give in to the sexual sin. That does remind us of Joseph, doesn't it? Mrs. Potiphar kept saying to him, lie with me, lie with me. He made sure other people were in the house so that it could never happen, and then she knew what he was doing and made sure it was just the two of them in the house. He refused. Verse 9 of Genesis 39, the very next chapter. Potiphar, he is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So Joseph was more concerned about Mrs. Potiphar's marriage vows than she was. Joseph and Judah, back to back. Judah chapter 38, Joseph chapter 39. Do you think that's on purpose? Comparing Judah with Joseph. Judah does not. Judah does give in to the sexual sin, I should say, and Joseph does not. Tuck that away when you're ready to study the Joseph story. We will at some point. By the way, in case you don't know, the reason why I'm cutting the Genesis study short is because when I first came here, I started in January, and I thought your quarters were January through March, April through June, and so I had this planned out to go through June, the end of June. And the elders were like, well, actually, our quarters start a little earlier. So we're going to try to get the auditorium, the adult classes, also on the same schedule as the others. And so I know this makes you terribly sad that I won't be here next week at this time. Walker Perkins, well, we'll talk about that here in a few minutes as well. All right, let me get back to the story. So Judah sees this temple prostitute, and what does she do? How does she respond? Let's read. Verse 16. He turned to her at the roadside and said, Tamar, how you doing? Now, he doesn't recognize her. Does not recognize her. That's important. Come, let us come into you. Let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? What's my payment? He answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. I think the text is trying to show us that Judah is overcome with passion here. He's not going to be dissuaded from this. What do I have to give you? What do you want? I'll pay you a kid, a goat, but I don't have a goat with me. Modernize this for me. The cord, the signet, the staff. What is he giving her? Proof that it's him. Exactly. I mean, this is crazy. Why is Judah giving in to this sexual sin at such cost? It's like taking out your driver's license and saying, here you go. Here's my credit cards. Here's my passport. Yes, it does remind you of Esau despising his birthright. Because Esau was, give me that red stuff. Give it to me. Red stuff. I need it. And you can hear that there in those verses where he cuts her off and says, hey, what do you need? Just tell me what you need and I'll do it. And so he has this relationship with her. And what results? Conception. Judah has just now given what Tamar wanted, a future with her own children. I mean, sick stuff. Can you believe this is in the Bible? there's worse stuff in the Bible than this. And we don't like to talk about it much. So in time, Judas says, all right, I got to go pay her back. Does he himself go to find the prostitute? He sends his friend, the Adullamite. We never told his name. So he has to go chase her down with the kid so he can get back the stuff. Why do you think Judas sent someone else? Embarrassed? Doesn't want to see this woman again? I don't know. Does the Adullamite, does Judas' friend find her? No. Why? Because she never really existed. There wasn't a temple prostitute in the area. It was always Tamar. 3 months pass by. And what happens? Judah is given word that Tamar has played the harlot. And on top of that, this is how we know, she's pregnant. And what is Judah's response to that? Finally, I can get rid of her. Yay! What does he say? Bring her out that she may be burned. So he has condemned Tamar for the sin of fornication. Who also has he condemned? Himself. Himself. Again, we're going to talk about this briefly in the sermon and try to make some application from it. But look at verse 24. We'll read that again. 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. That's how the ESV smooths it out. She has played the harlot. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out that she may be burned. Bless you. As she was brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law. By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Now what? What choice does he have? She's got the proof. See the driver's license here? Whose picture is that? See the passport here, huh? See that? Now, whose signet ring is this? Whose staff is this? Everyone would have known it was Judas. And his response was, verse 26, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her my son, Shelah. And he did not know her again. They never had a sexual relationship again. And then the story continues. We're going to finish the chapter. Genesis 38, verse 27. When the time of her labor came, so 6 months later, there were twins in her womb. Who does that remind you of? Jacob and Esau. And when and tell me the story about Jacob and Esau's birth in Genesis 25. Esau emerges from their womb, and who is latching onto his heel? Well, Jacob. That's not exactly what happens here, but look at verse 28. When she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. That's a neat way to identify the firstborn. But then what happens? As he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore his name was called Perez. So the first son wasn't actually the firstborn. That's a good trivia question, isn't it? What kid was born with clothing? Who was wearing clothing? Afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So Zerah was the one who had he was, I guess, supposed to be the firstborn. Who do you think carries on the Abrahamic promise? Who is the one that Jesus is descended from? Which one? Perez. And so you have echoes of Jacob and Esau, the older serving the younger. The firstborn isn't the firstborn. Isn't that interesting? Well, let's think about connections with Jacob also. I'm not sure how far I would take these but I find them interesting. I'll just share them with you and let you think about them. In the story of Tamar, Tamar deceives Judah. Rebekah and Jacob deceived Isaac. Very intentionally deceived him. So Jacob deceived his father. Tamar deceived his son, Judah. Judah did not recognize Tamar because she had a veil on. He had no idea who she was. Isaac did not recognize Jacob. Why not? When it was time to give the blessing. All right, he disguised himself. His dad was blind, practically. Maybe he had cataracts. Who knows? And he says, "Well, let me kiss you, son. Come here. Let me hug you." And what was Isaac really trying to do? You know, smell him, touch him. But how did Jacob counteract that? He had stuff on him. The skins of the goat that they had killed for the supper. And also, whose clothes was he wearing? Esau. So he smelled like Esau. And then here's another observation. Judah realized that he had made a mistake. In the end, he says, "She, Tamar, is more righteous than I." Isaac also did the same. When Jacob is blessed, he leaves. Esau comes in and says, "Hey, Dad, okay, I'm here. I'm ready for the blessing." And Isaac starts shaking. He realizes what has happened. He says, "I have made him Lord." Does this make Tamar a female Jacob? Something to think about. And then here's this slide I already showed you. I got to hurry. I'm almost out of time. And I want to show you a couple of other issues here. By the way, here's Hebrews 7:14. Jesus is not a descendant of Reuben, of Simeon, of Levi. He is of the tribe of Judah, the lion's whelp. Judah changes over time. In Genesis 37, verse 27, after Reuben says, "Let's not kill him, let's put him in the pit." But then who is the one who said, "Let's sell him into slavery"? That was Judah. And then as Judah is working to change, he says, "Dad, I got to go back to Egypt, and I will protect Benjamin." And then in the story itself, when he's standing before Joseph, and I'll remind you of this when we go over the Joseph story. I'll remind you of what Jacob's doing here. Judah approached Joseph. He didn't know it was Joseph. But he makes this impassioned speech. It's the climax of the Joseph story. Because after Judah's speech, where he says, "Please, please, take everybody else, leave everybody else alone, take me, kill me, let everybody go home," Joseph is so overwhelmed with emotion that he says to them, "Everybody get out, I am Joseph." He reveals himself to his brothers. So who's the main character in the Joseph story? Joseph. Who is the best supporting actor? Judah. As you read the Joseph story, you'll see Judah. In fact, the Joseph story begins in chapter 37. It is interrupted by Judah and Tamar and then resumed in Genesis 39. We are done. I'm going to try to make some application in our sermon. Don't normally do that. Have a direct connection between the Bible class and the sermon, but I am this morning. Next week, I'm going to be with the young adults, excited about that. And Walker is going to be in here with you guys. Do you have books yet?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so he has some books. And I know you're looking forward to Walker and this very good study on the first principles of Christianity. Thank you for putting up with me for 5 months. And I really appreciate your participation in our Genesis study. Thank you.